and welcome to Sports Spill. For many of us, the COVID pandemic has caused a rethink on how we live our lives and see ourselves in society. But for Sophie Carrigill, this is something she had to do 10 years ago. Aged just 16, Sophie was involved in an accident that would change her life forever. Yet, while she initially struggled to accept her change in identity, Sophie has transformed herself into a highly inspirational and motivational individual. A star of the GB women's basketball team, Sophie has played a crucial role in the rise of the squad over the last few years, including a World Championship silver medal and reaching their first ever Paralympic semi-final at Rio. It's not just on the court where Sophie excels, but also off it too. Alongside driving for greater accessibility, inclusion and opportunity for disabled people in sport and life generally, she also wants to help generate equality for female athletes and use her platform to show that anyone can achieve their dreams, whatever stands in their way. Despite her young age, she's already making a huge name for herself with all her great work, having been named on the prestigious Forbes 30 by 30 list and also selected in the first cohort of the Women's Sport Trust Unlocked program. We discuss all this and much more in a wide-ranging interview, so make sure you stick around. So welcome back, listeners, to Sportsville. And as I said in the introduction there, I am delighted to say that we've got our second women's wheelchair basketball star on the show. 3 years after the first, we are delighted to be joined by Sophie Carrigill. So first of all, Sophie, thank you for coming on the show. And how are you at the moment? Where are you at the moment?
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. I'm good. Yeah, we're at camp at the moment in Loughborough. So we get to stay in the Elite Athlete Hotel, which is pretty nice. But yeah, we're basically bubbling up so that we can train like full contact. So yeah, it's been a mad few months to a year, and it's just good to be back with the girls and being able to train properly.
So is this your first time together in a camp since this whole pandemic started, or have you had a few opportunities before?
Yeah, this is our third camp now, but we only started them sort of April, May time. But since then we've been training at where we used to be based, or still are sort of based, at the EIS in Sheffield. But because of like you coming in and out of that, it's not technically like a bubble, so we've not been able to do as close contact stuff there. So working a lot more on our individual skills, just like 3v3 work. Whereas when we come into a camp, we can control the environment a lot more, so the risks are a bit less, so we can do that 5v5 stuff. So yeah, it's only been a couple of months since we've been able to play 5v5, which, yeah, it's obviously what I love the most. I love competing. The other sides of the sport obviously are really important as well, but what I love about basketball is actually playing it. So that's been, yeah, really nice to get back to.
I was going to say then, because indoor sports and disability indoor sports have been hit hard, and that whereas, you know, a lot of sports are working, hockey, cricket, you know, we've had times in previous scenarios this time last year we could go back, but indoor sports has been hit really hard, I guess. Yeah. How good did it feel just getting back on a court for the first time?
Yeah, it was amazing. I think I had probably about 6 months where we just weren't on court at all, which is so surreal for me because I'm so used to having my life sort of mapped out by when my training sessions are and almost someone dictating that to me and to the whole squad, you know. So it's, yeah, it was really weird those first couple of months sort of adjusting to that different way of life and being in control of yourself a bit more. And I'm sure that is the case with absolutely everybody who's gone through this pandemic, which is everybody in the world. So, you know, everyone's been affected in some sort of way. But yeah, that feeling of getting back on court. I mean, I was rusty to begin with. I think we all were. But we had an extra year to prepare for the games. So, yeah, it's allowed us to obviously get back up to where we were. And we're just playing so well at the moment. It's great to see.
And how did you manage to, you said you came back feeling a bit rusty. How did you find it, you know, not being able to train, and were there any sort of, did you have to set up some rudimentary sort of skills and things in your house, or how did you manage to get through that? Because I can't imagine it was easy for you.
Yeah, no, not easy at all, but actually it allowed me just to take my foot off the gas a little bit. I think how British Wheelchair Basketball sort of helped us through that process was putting on enough stuff that we could still be active and still keep fit and do group sessions, but at the same time really focusing on this is about your well-being, it's about your family, it's about keeping safe. So having that focus almost allowed me to explore other things that I was interested in and wanted to do. I was part of the Women's Sport Trust Unlocked program last year, so that was really sort of getting my juices flowing in a lot of things outside of sport. So although it was hard to, you know, you then had to find that self-motivation to train, which coming from a team sport, it's really easy to play, like go out and play basketball because you're with your mates, you're having a good time. I love the sport, so it almost feels like you're not exercising. Whereas when, you know, that was obviously not allowed, it was then finding other ways to be active, which was, for me, I bought a ski erg machine, which I have a real love-hate relationship for, because it was great in terms of giving me that level of fitness that I needed to maintain through lockdown, but hate it because it's really hard. So, and like, you don't really notice the fitness level of playing sport because you're just doing it and you're decision-making and you're like thinking about things. Whereas when you're just on a ski erg, all you're thinking about is, oh my God, this is awful. When is it going to stop? So yeah, it was quite difficult. A different mentality for me. And my boyfriend also is a full-time athlete and he's an endurance athlete too, so I kept on like comparing myself to him because he could just sit on a bike for hours and hours on end, and I was like, why am I not like that? Why can't I do that? So that was quite challenging, just to realize actually we're two completely different athletes and we do two completely different things. I'm never going to be like him and he's never going to be able to play basketball like I can. So, you know, it's yeah, it was just understanding that. So that was my main struggle, really, always being competitive.
Was it, I take it, it wasn't just sort of in gym and sort of those endurance sessions where it's competitive. I imagine things between the two of you must be quite competitive anyway, then, given that you're both full-time athletes.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. But I think me more so, and you know, he's not even really seen me play yet because we got together just before like lockdown started, really, and never has like seen me play. So I almost feel like I'm missing out a bit, because I can see how great he is because he does all his training indoors or goes out on his bike or whatever, and he's not really had the chance to see like how good like we are as a team. So yeah, I can't wait till that day, till we can finally compete on like an international stage, and yeah, he gets to see how good I really am. Not meaning to sound big-headed at all, but we've just done plenty of garage sessions where I've yeah, not been uber motivated, so yeah, I can't wait to show him.
I mean, we'll come on to sort of the success of the team and things in a bit, but as yeah, you guys are pretty good, as being quite frank. But I guess going back to something I touched on briefly earlier, but how was it for you when certain sports were going back and were able to go back, but the government and the way things were still saying indoor sports can't go back, you can't go back, and they weren't really giving you much help? I know a lot of sports, I know badminton were quite outspoken about it, and yeah. I guess how frustrating was it for you that some athletes could go back and yet seemingly yeah. You weren't being given much advice or help or anything?
Yeah, it was tough. Yeah, it's a difficult one, really, because the government at some point as well opened like leisure facilities and opened courts up, but then we were still not going back just because of the risk of the added, I suppose, vulnerability of being a disability sport as well. We wanted to get all the processes in place and make sure everything was right before we went back. And I think people were worried about like what happens if someone gets it and who's responsible and, you know, all that political stuff that just takes away the fun of just playing sport. So yeah, for me, it was quite frustrating, and I'd have been the first to say that, you know, I wish we were back sooner, but actually what we've done and how we're looking now is actually testament to taking things slow, having a bit of a break, using that time like wisely to work on things that we didn't really have the time to work on before, and you know, working on individual skills and things like that, that we've come out now and I think we're flying. So yeah, I'll hold my hands up and say I was wrong at the time to be complaining, because it's worked out for us in the end.
taking the time away to go and do other things, you, as you mentioned before, were part of the Women's Sports Trust Unlocked program. So we've had Emily DeFrond and Tess Howard on the show talking about that. We had Ronan Lloyd on as well.
Oh, cool.
I mean, everyone that's been involved with it has just had so many positive things to say about it. And I'm just wondering for you, sort of, what did being on that program, like, did it change anything about you? Did it bring out certain things? Sort of, what did you find that the being on that amazing program benefited you?
Yeah, it just changed loads. That's so cool. You've had some of the other girls on the show as well. Yeah, we had such a good time. Like, we were obviously all meant to meet in person, but then obviously the world locked down and it was all through Zoom. And actually, it was a real, like, saviour almost, you know, having that one thing that you went to once a week, which was just a hangout with this group of girls who were wanting to make changes in women's sport, that were just had aspirational dreams that, you know, we all came together and sort of tried to work on and think about more. And I think I just learned so much more about women's sport in general, other sports. That was a great thing. I met like 40 other people that I'd never met before, and built those connections, and, you know, they'll be friends for life now. So I think that was a real big takeaway for me from the program. But also, I guess personally, it was really life-changing, because it actually made me understand my like own self-worth and my own like I guess like the position that I'm in, and understand that I do have like a voice and my voice is valuable and people want to listen, and understanding that, you know, reaching out to brands or businesses or things like that, these people are actually thrilled that an elite athlete wants to get in touch with them and wants to work with them. So just understanding that, I guess, because I think coming from a minority sport, obviously a disability sport, I often like I'd probably just be a bit more reserved in how I thought I was or what I deserved, you know. So I think it was just about learning about that and understanding that I did have a voice and it was valuable. And I think also just spending those times like week after week going over like things that we were passionate about, things that we wanted to speak up on. For me, I really honed in on, you know, it's all about inclusion for me. Like, I'm passionate no matter what sort of sector that's in. It's education, it's sport, it's travel, whatever it is, inclusion just runs like through my veins, because I just think it's so important that, you know, everyone gets a fair chance to participate, to enjoy, to go out and do things. And I think that also comes with the representation of, specifically for me, disabled women in the media, in lifestyle, in sports, in anywhere, you know, being represented, is just so important to be, you know, for young girls coming through that may have disabilities, or women, whoever, you know, to think, to be seen. You know, there's that saying, you can't be it if you can't see it. So I think that's something that I really wanted to focus on and, you know, have taken forwards, and hopefully I'm, you know, representing in some sort of way and can be a role model for some people in the future.
How do you find that going from, as you say, you've gone from someone who maybe, and a lot of the athletes I've noticed, they've gone from maybe being a bit afraid to talk about certain issues to having that confidence and doing it. But I guess sort of making that transition and sort of, you know, those first one, two sort of posts or things that you do, how do you find that sort of going from someone who's maybe only ever talked about just their sport and everything before to talking about wider issues that are of great importance?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, really, because as you say, like, we're so used to just talking about sport and our achievements and what's coming up next, that then you've got to really reframe questions that you're being asked or what you want to put out there and turn it on its head and be like, I'm doing this because, or I'm, you know, this is, you know, making it about your key issues, your key messages that you want to be getting across. And I think as an athlete with not a massive platform, but at least some kind of platform, I think we owe it to the next generation, the people coming through the sport, you know, we owe it to people like that to speak up and to not be afraid and to ask for more. You know, accessibility in this country is not good enough, and it could be so much better. The thought about disabled people, putting disabled people in your mind at the forefront when you are designing anything, when you are organizing an event, making sure that every single person can access your event or your restaurant or what your sport, whatever it is, I just think could be better. And it's about speaking up about those things, and knowing who to approach, what to say. And yeah, I've sort of gone off on a massive tangent, haven't I, really? But yeah, it was, yeah, that's, I can't remember your question now, sorry.
That's fine. You are a woman and you are a disabled athlete. And in the world of sport, especially in this country, they're two of the groups or, you know, two of the types of people that have traditionally not had the opportunities that men and particularly white men and able-bodied men have had over the years. Do you think that the lockdown has highlighted this, or is, as in, you know, the way things have come back, or is it more of a case of people have had time to sit down and actually think these issues have been in place for too long now, and we've actually got the time to sit down and work out how best to try and start to overcome them?
Yeah, I think a bit of both. I definitely think people have had more time, and actually the need is there. Like, people want to see women playing sport on TV at an international level, competing at the highest standards. People are demanding that now. And I think the fitness industry, I think, is changing slightly around, you know, seeing different types of women out there. Not just, you know, 10 years ago, and any woman that was on TV or that was in a magazine would be, you know, tall, blonde, skinny, and would look a certain way, you know, the model sort of figure. Whereas now we want to look at women that look different because we can relate to them so much more. And I think that is what, you know, the public are asking for. They want to see athletic women. They want to see different shapes, different sizes. You know, a rugby player looks completely different to a basketball player. And the need is there. So I guess that's why, you know, that's what maybe I think lockdown has helped with, is that companies and brands are understanding the need of their customers and what they're actually asking for. More equal representation, I think, of women. So yeah, probably a balance of the two, that, you know, the time has given these companies to think about that. And people have just become more aware of women's sport. You know, it was hit a lot harder than the men's sport. You know, you look at just the comparison between men's football and women's football. Men's football, the Premiership, went back, you know, almost within 6 weeks to compete, you know, because the money's there. And if they didn't, they'd be losing so much money through TV rights and all sorts of things like that, I'm sure. I wouldn't want to ever get into that. It's probably way too complicated. But, you know, they found a way to get back. And whereas women's football was not even anywhere close to that. So, you know, there's still a massive disparity in the attention and the funding and the, I guess, publicity that, you know, you compare men and women's sport to. It's massive disparity still. So lockdown has probably helped in that way, give people time to think. But now it's about a call to action. It's about, what are you going to do to make a change? What are you going to do to represent women more widely and put them out there? And I think things are changing. And I'd love to think that the Women's Sport Trust are having a massive impact on that. I'm lucky enough now to work with that team, who ran and still run the Unlocked program with another group of amazing athletes this time around. So I think they're making waves within the sporting industry, doing amazing research and bringing out, you know, facts and figures that show how much difference there is and how much can be done. And so I hope that that's helping as well, you know, getting people's attention.
Yeah, the Women's Sport Trust are doing amazing work. I was invited to a webinar they did a few weeks ago, just about, you know, where women's sports are and what changes can be made. And it was quite nice to see in one or two of the stats that actually England hockey were performing quite well. So it's nice to see that that we're doing okay, but I know there's a lot more we can do. How important are things like the Women's Sport Trust going forward for female athletes? Because they've empowered 40 athletes on last year's programme to be able to talk more openly and want to drive change. They've got ever-growing membership, board members, people following their work. Companies like them, are they, you know, a massive part of our future and in getting eventually one day that equality for female athletes.
Yeah, they're 100% game changers. You know, I'm privileged now to be able to see a little bit of the work behind the scenes, and what they do is incredible. You know, they're constantly every day changing the game for women's sport and finding ways that they can do that through their research or through, you know, working on the Unlocked program. And like you say, it's giving that voice to that group of athletes, giving them the education and the tools. And it's not just a, it's not just like a, oh, here's a program, you can get better at public speaking. It's like understanding the meaning behind that. It's understanding your why and your purpose, and being able to then deliver that successfully. And it's about, so on the program, you get paired with an activator, and it's about them activating your journey, you know, and giving you the skills and confidence and network and contacts to get yourself into the right place. So they are massively going to shape the landscape, I think, of women's sport. They have done already and continue to do. And it's, for me, it's just about pushing those boundaries and banging on those doors until someone opens them up. And I think it is happening. It's just about getting it to be more consistent, I think.
How are you finding it being on almost the other side of the fence? Last year, you were part of the cohort invited in. Now you're part of the Women's Sport Trust, almost looking after the current cohort. What's it like being on the other side?
Yeah, it's really strange. I knew it would be, because I obviously had been on the program and like seen that side of it, that I didn't really know what went on behind the scenes. So I knew that it would be different. And I wondered how like I'd get on with all the athletes, because obviously I was like very much on the fence. Like, I'd been there and I'd had that experience, so I wanted to share some of my experience as well. But then I was helping run the program and organize it, you know, so it was very much like, it was my first sort of like professional role, I suppose, it within sport. I've worked, you know, part-time in the past, but never sort of within the sporting industry and at the same time as being an athlete still. So I knew that I would find that a bit strange, because I'm so used to just playing that athlete role and not necessarily having like a strategic, like, I don't know, like professional head on my shoulders. But it's just been amazing, and it's almost like I'm getting to do the program again, because I'm obviously involved in all the workshops, and you know, we've got different people coming in to deliver things, and there's just different conversations happening. So I feel, you know, I feel like I've got a go at it a second time round.
You're listening to Sportspiel, the Players Podcast.
And I mean, the impact it's had on you, as we've mentioned, is so clear to see. If it's, as I said to you before we started recording, like, you've done so many interviews, I've seen you on a lot of things in the last year, which has been fantastic to see. And also then, I think you were listed in the Forbes 30 under 30, you know, alongside the likes of Marcus Rashford, Lucy Bronze, Peniel Harder, Dominic Thiem, Maro Itoje. I mean, yeah. How did you feel when you heard about that? And, you know, what did that mean to you?
It was so surreal, because I didn't actually know, and this sounds so naive to me, but like how big of a deal it was. Obviously, I know Forbes is a really big deal, but I just thought that was about like being rich, and I'm definitely not on that list. So, but yeah, it was just amazing when I, you know, I got nominated for it, and then you had to send in like a bio and a bit about yourself, what you've been up to, and actually writing all that down was quite a good like task to do, I think, because it sort of reminds you of where you've come from and what you're doing and the things that you're most passionate about. So I never expected to be selected at all. So yeah, it was just a massive honour. And obviously, it's, I mean, what a network to be part of. If you wanted to, you know, do some good networking, like, I reckon Forbes is up there with where you want to start networking with people. So yeah, hopefully it sort of takes off. They're delivering webinars and, you know, things like that to help connect people in different fields. So yeah, it's really exciting, and obviously a great title, so I can't complain.
I guess, and then how does it feel for you? Someone who's said yourself in a minority sport, you have a platform, but it's not the platform that you maybe deserve. But you're, you know, a lot in this list alongside the likes of, you know, Rashford, Bronze, you know, some of the biggest names in world sport. What does that mean to you, I guess?
Yeah, it's a complete honour. Like, if you'd have said to me when I was like 10 years old that I'd be in the same like list of, you know, same list as those types of people, you know, who are at the top of their game at an international level in like major sports, I just wouldn't have believed you. I was absolutely sports mad when I was growing up. My dad was a professional golfer and probably instilled a lot of that in me. We played a lot of sport. I did everything sort of after school and it was just a massive part of my life. And I absolutely love it still. You know, I do it because I love playing and yes, it's given me a bit more of a platform than I would have had I not been doing it. But ultimately that's not the end goal. It's about, you know, just loving playing. So yeah, to be, you know, in and amongst those types of people like Marcus Rashford, come on, he's had the most incredible year ever. You know, in all the change that he's doing and he sets just an amazing example. So yeah, it's pretty cool to be amongst those.
You mentioned there about how you've always been sports mad, and we've talked here about a lot of what you've been doing and off the court. But it's some with all that amazing stuff, it's sometimes easy to forget that you are a world class wheelchair basketballer and part of a world class wheelchair basketball team. Yeah. And I guess, you know, how much does it mean to you every time you're out on that court and you're wearing the British jersey and you're competing for your country? I mean, how does that feel?
Yeah, just the most incredible feeling. It really is, like, it doesn't get old. You know, being able to put that vest on and play for your country, sing the national anthem. I've not done it for a really long time and I can't wait to get back competing, because it does still, I just get that buzz, that adrenaline, just it gets me going. And I love, like, it's almost performing for me. Like, I feel like it is, you know, you're performing, you know, as though you're on stage, you're on a certain type of stage, you know, and I just love it. And, you know, Tokyo's not going to be quite the same. There's not going to be crowds there and it'll be different, but it's still, you know, the most amazing feeling to be able to put on that vest and go out and compete for Great Britain.
It's amazing, even though you've had a year off with COVID, what you've achieved in your first eight years of playing, with European silver medals, World Cup silver medals, an under 25 World Championship gold, what you've done at the Paralympics in Rio. I don't know, are there any particular highlights that stand out for you, or is it just sort of all a blur at the moment?
No, definite highlights. I mean, Rio for me was one of the best experiences of my life. I just absolutely loved it. I know we came fourth and, you know, that was really bittersweet at the time. You know, it was a success because we'd never got that far before. But obviously you're the one team who doesn't leave with a medal, who makes it to the semi-finals. So it's, it was a hard pill to swallow, but just one of the best experiences of my life, that, you know, you're on such a different level, the whole world is watching, and it just, that just feels amazing to me. To have wheelchair basketball on that type of stage is just incredible, and yeah, that'll always be a massive, massive moment in my life. But I think for the team, our world championship silver medal is definitely it's our best achievement to date, and it's one of my like best memories, just because of the journey it took to get there. We came off a 9-game losing streak going into that tournament, and we basically had nothing to lose. We all sort of just, like, you know, held our hands up and were like, right, girls, come on, we just got to dig deep and win these games. And we just really did, like, take each game as it came and just get it done. Like, we were very, like, we've just got to get this job done, and that's what we went out to do. And that was a lot of ownership from the girls as well. Like, this is our job. Like, this is what we want to do. We want to perform. So that was incredible. And obviously then to make it to the final, we'd never made it to a final on a world stage before. So super impressive performances as well. And to say we came off a nine game losing streak, it shows a lot of, you know, psychological strength, I like to think, and, you know, a lot of hardiness. We're tough women out there.
It's quite a British sort of mentality and thing to do as well, going into the tournament. It was almost underdogs, written off, and then come back from the dead. But what What was the feeling in the camp going into that tournament then? Because you, like you say, you had that 9-game losing streak, and I was listening to the cricket earlier, and they always like to say you like to go into a tournament with a settled squad, and actually, you know, you're in a winning position. But if you look at Great Britain hockey, went into the Rio Olympics having bombed at the Champions Trophy a few months before, go and win gold. Like, what does it almost take the pressure off then, having that that losing streak, and, you know, people sort of not really talking about you? Does that almost take the pressure off and give you that maybe more freedom to play?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I still think we felt, you know, a sense of pressure, because ultimately your funding is always on the line, you know, when you're competing at that level. So I think there's always that bit of pressure. But yeah, it definitely takes it off. It you know, takes that target off your back, I suppose. You know, people sort of might not respect you in the way that they should, just because we'd had a, you know, a rough ride leading into it. But it never deterred us. You know, we don't take things too seriously, I don't think, as a team. Like, we're quite lighthearted. We've got a lot of jokers on the team who keep the morale high, and I think that's really important when you've gone through a bit of a, don't know if I can swear, but I'm not gonna, you know, a terrible time. I think just our spirits and our, like, you know, who we are as a group just kept us going, and we just glued together like we never have before, I think. It sort of brought us together, so we weren't really thinking about what was going on outside of our squad, which was probably a good thing.
You've had a lot of success, we've mentioned, but you actually had a very successful start to your career in your major international debut, I believe, at the Europeans in 2013, and won a bronze straight away. How was that, sort of your first experience of an international tournament and to come away with a medal hanging around your neck?
Yeah, I mean, I can't take any credit for that, because I was definitely the 12th man on that team and the bench warmer all the time. So can't take much credit for it. But the experience, you know, getting I did get a court time, obviously, but not, you know, you've got to start somewhere. And the girls at the time were saying, look, we've all been there. We know, obviously, you want to play because you won't be there if you didn't. But I think you've got to do a bit of time on the bench before you can make your way up to be one of, like, the key players. So, yeah, it was definitely a learning experience for me. I'd never competed internationally before. So just seeing all, like, you know, all the stands, all the crowd, all, like, the sponsorship, like, it was like a real deal, you know. I thought I was, like, a celebrity at the time, you know, because it was all, you know, all singing, all dancing for us. It was great. So, yeah, real good insight into what it was like, and a good preparation, I think, for me for the rest of my career.
And then, does that also, you're at a tournament like that and you don't get maybe as much game time as you'd like, how does that then make you hungrier? You want to come back and you want to be that key player, and you want to be out there, you know, scoring the points, winning the games, you're leading from the front.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that has motivated me my whole career and still now. You know, basketball, you'll never play the same 5 players for the whole game. At least we don't in our team. So you'll always be constantly rotating, which it's great that we can do that. But yeah, it'll still motivate me for the day I, you know, stop playing, that you want as much court time. You want to be the best that you can be whilst you're on the court in the time that you have. So yeah, definitely those first tournaments where I wasn't playing as much, it motivated me, and I wanted to prove myself that, you know, I was deserving of court time. I needed to improve a lot. You know, I still had not a clue what I was doing, really. A brand new sport, you know, thrown in at the deep end. So yeah, it took me some time to learn about the sport and how to play at the top level. But those experiences early days were monumental in my career, really.
And then not long after that, you went on to captain your country for a few years. How much of an honour was that? And, you know, what did it feel like being, you know, you literally were then leading from the front?
Yeah, it was a massive, massive switch. We got some new coaches come into the programme, and, you know, I was one of the youngest members of the team at the time, and I'd just started uni, we'd just centralised, there was a lot of change going on, and I think he obviously wanted to change up the, you know, the programme, and, you know, I guess he saw in me probably what I didn't even see in myself at the time. You know, those leadership qualities and, you know, setting a good example. I think I was a hard worker and, you know, still am, but I was hungry and I was motivated, you know, as more than anybody in those moments, because I wanted to be the best, you know. So I think he probably saw that in me. And yeah, it was just a massive honour. You know, I didn't even know if I'd get selected for the tournament, never mind then be asked to be captain of the team. And yeah, it will always be. It was for 4 years and it was just an amazing experience for me. So I'll have always fond memories of that. And the girls are such a good group. Don't get me wrong, we had our ups and downs as any group of girls would, but, you know, it was a pleasure.
You've gone from then being that player in 2013, sort of getting a little bit of game time, but not much, to being captain, to then being selected for your first Paralympics ahead of 2016. How did that feel? You know, you get the call or the email, I'm not quite sure how you guys do it, but then you're told that you're on the plane, you're going to one of the biggest multi-sport events in the world.
Yeah, amazing feeling. We do it in face-to-face meetings when we can before COVID. But yeah, it was just, I cried. And that whole year for me was a real, it's quite a traumatic year. I was in my third year at uni, so I was trying to finish a dissertation and that was stressful. And then at the start of the year, I actually ruptured my bowel. So it perforated and I needed life-saving surgery pretty much. And that was right at the end of January. And I was cut open, really big abdominal surgery. And I remember saying to my mum at the time when I was going into the theatre, because they tried to treat it without having surgery, but it was too severe. And I said, if I have to have this operation, like, I'm not going to Rio. And I was convinced that it would be too long of a road back to get me back in time for Rio. So after the surgery, I had 12 weeks out of playing basketball. I was doing a lot of rehab stuff. I wasn't even allowed to put my arms above my head for like 10 weeks or something, because just the risk of like re-injuring or you know, pulling any muscles or tissue or whatever from the stitching. So it was a really hard time, but I was the most motivated I've ever been to get back. And you know, I'd worked really hard for the past 3.5-4 years to be in that position and to be able to put myself forward and be selected for a Paralympic Games. So it just made me so motivated to make sure that I did everything and anything I could to give myself the best chance of being selected. And thankfully I recovered pretty well. There was no complications or anything. And yeah, I managed to get selected and was on the plane. So it was even more of an amazing feeling just because of that doubt at the start of the year that I didn't think I'd get there. So that's why I had such a good experience in Rio, just because of, you know, the relief and the thrill, I suppose, of actually being there.
And what was it like then, sort of, because I guess sort of wheelchair basketball competitions, you do get fans, but you know, it's only one sort of sport generally happening on the day, whereas you get to the Paralympics and it's this massive multi-sport event. You've got athletes from all over the world, you know, athletes from all different sports. Was it a bit of a culture shock first getting there, or is it just something you thrived on?
Definitely something I thrived on. And I'd been to London as a spectator, so I'd been in the Paralympic Inspiration Programme, which they sort of put on to, I guess, like educate and, you know, any upcoming athletes, give them a chance to see what it's like sort of behind the scenes. So I'd had that bit of like experience, I suppose, which really helped me understand like how much of a massive scale the Games is on compared to anything we ever go to. So I was a little bit prepared, but I don't think you can ever prepare yourself fully for that first game under massive spotlights, and, you know, just surrounded by, I think we had like 12,000 in most of our games, 12,000 people, and most of my family there just like screaming their heads off as well. So yeah, it was, you can't prepare for that other than doing it. And thankfully I loved it. And, you know, I love that type of experience. I think, you know, playing in front of a crowd gets me, you know, riled up and in the right place to play my sport. So, yeah, amazing experience. It felt great.
Obviously, must have felt even better given what you'd been through earlier that year. But you've come through that life-saving surgery on your bowel, which, you know, is difficult for, I mean, or not, probably not impossible for a lot of people to get through, but not, yeah. You've got through that. But I guess having been through a very difficult period before and come through that to be able to play basketball, did that sort of, those memories of what you'd already been through, sort of, did they help you through with this sort of, this second really difficult period?
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, just to touch on, like, obviously the reason I now play wheelchair basketball is when I was 16, I was involved in a car accident, which was near fatal for me. You know, again, had life-saving surgery at the time, and I'm very lucky to be alive anyway. So I think that experience definitely has shaped who I am as a person. So I think faced with anything that is like that in terms of adversity or trauma or, you know, setbacks, I know that you can get through them. And, you know, I went from being an able-bodied 16-year-old who was living her best life, who wanted to, you know, go on to university and play sports and, you know, dance in nightclubs and, like, you know, have that life. That was what I dreamed of. To this, like, you know, a whole life was shaken up completely, and I had a completely new identity as a disabled woman, or disabled girl at the time. So yeah, my life completely changed, but those experiences have shown me that if you can cope with that, like, really, you can cope with anything. And if you can come out the other side, I really do think I'm a better, stronger, more resilient person from having had that experience. So I think it's almost, you know, those things are sent to try the strongest people out there. And I think I've had my fair share now. So whoever's doing that can stop. but I think I've proved myself that I can get over, you know, my fair amount of battles and trauma and whatever. So I'd like a bit of a break for now. That'd be nice. but yeah, those, you know, everything you go through can send you two ways, I suppose. And there was a lot of people that end up with spinal cord injuries, which is what I have. You know, that don't, you know, that don't go on to live a fulfilled life because they, you know, can't get over what's happened to them and can't see past their disability, I suppose. Not to see past it in a way that you don't acknowledge it and don't own it, because, you know, I completely own that I'm a badass disabled woman, you know, but that, you know, they just can't find a way to navigate it. And, you know, I put it down to having amazing family support, and my friends were just incredible at the time and wouldn't have let me go any other way. You know, so they really pulled me along, which I'm, yeah, very grateful for.
And for anyone listening who wants to maybe find out a bit more about your journey, there was a really powerful BBC Sport piece that you did back in August, which I remember watching at the time and thinking, so I already knew your story because sort of following, sort of after speaking to Amy, sort of following the team quite a bit. But, you know, the way you did it was really powerful, really moving. How did it feel, sort of, I know you've told your story before, but, you know, having BBC Sport telling your story where, you know, one of the most visited websites in the country, was it quite daunting, quite scary, or quite empowering?
It was, yeah, a bit of everything. It was definitely empowering. Because actually they reached out to me and knew that it was coming up to my 10-year anniversary of the accident, mainly probably because I celebrate every year like it's, you know, my next birthday. They knew it was coming up and reached out and wanted to do a story about it, which made me think, wow, people like want to hear stories, you know, they want to hear what we were up to, and, you know, it's whatever you're comfortable with sharing, but they, you know, if BBC Sport want to hear me speak, like, you know, then other outlets and other media, you know, industries and sectors are going to want to hear my story too. And, you know, not just my story, but what I want to share around the wider, you know, community of being a disabled woman as well. So, yeah, it was a complete honour. And I just very, that whole time, I think, of like coming up to 10 years and, you know, it's a big chunk of your life. You know, so it's like a third of, it's more than a third of my life that I've now lived in a chair. Soon it'll be half my life that I've lived in a chair. So it was really, yeah, empowering to talk about it and to be able to share my story in that way. And I'm glad it came across really well and how I wanted it, you know, to come. But yeah, it's not, you know, the next 10 years are going to be just as amazing. So hopefully I'll have some more stories to tell at my 20th anniversary.
Make sure you follow Sportspiel on social media. Search for Sportspiel Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or on LinkedIn.
I remember asking Amy a very similar question when we spoke nearly 3 years ago. But I did the same thing with Sammy Kinghorn, the sprinter, wheelchair sprinter, because you have a sort of similarish stories in that you were both in your teens, both had these life-changing accidents and gone on to become incredible athletes. But why wheelchair basketball? Of all the sports, why did that one appeal to you most?
I think because it was a team sport. I played a lot of netball when I was younger, and that was probably the sport that I was best at. So it sort of fit right, you know, still having the same sort of transferable skills. And it was honestly, it was the closest thing to my house. It was 10 minutes away from where I was living at the time. And it just seemed like the right option. I tried a few other sports earlier on, but I tried tennis, which again, I'd played religiously all my life. But I just couldn't get to grips with that being the same sport, but I had to play it so differently. Like everything I'd learned growing up was like almost completely irrelevant, like unlearn all those things because you need to play it really differently. So I wasn't probably in the right headspace at the time to unlearn a lot of that and like get to grips with it being the same sport, but oh, I'm having to do it so differently because of my disability. Whereas basketball was a whole new sport to me. I'd never played it before, other than like messing around on the street with my friends or whatever. I think that was a nice sort of refreshing, like new thing that I could do rather than sort of going backwards and doing something I was doing, but doing it so differently. I don't know if that makes sense, but it certainly did to me. It does now, maybe not at the time. I wasn't really that, you know, I wasn't thinking about it that coherently. I was just doing it. But honestly, I was like terrible at the time. So I don't know why I didn't stop after the first session. I suppose it shows my, I like to call it determined nature, but most people probably just call me stubborn. but yeah, you know, I was really, really bad and I just kept going back because I enjoyed it and I wanted to get better and it was something for me to focus on. I don't know why I stuck at it really. I guess it was, I still ask myself that question, like why, you know, I'd sort of reflect every year and is this still what I want to do? Is, you know, because there's lots of career options I hope that I have in my future. So it's always good just to make sure you're still on the right path and you're wanting to do what I'm still doing. And it always comes back to yes, because I absolutely love it. So I think that was probably why I carried on at the start, was I was growing this love for it. And even though I had no idea where it was going to take me, I just liked having sport back in my life. So it was a big part of me that after my accident needed to be refilled, and basketball definitely did that for me.
It mentioned there about how you were sporty before the accident, and I guess sort of that is not only did you have all the physical changes, but also the changes that you mentioned before in identity, that almost transition from being one thing to another. Do you find that sport and wheelchair basketball was something that really helped you through that, and being able to draw back on something that you already knew and just that helped change your identity because you could still do it in the different way you were living your life?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it definitely helped with just accepting who I was now. You know, I sort of after my accident, and I'm ashamed to even say this, but went through a period of time where I didn't think I wanted to be associated with other disabled people because I didn't know anybody else. You know, I was the only person in my friendship group that had a disability or any terms of sort of difference, you know, in that sense. And I just wanted to go back to what was my normal life. So I wasn't ready to accept it early on. But I think basketball and playing sport definitely helped with that. and helped me just accept who I was and the new community that I was a part of. And now I don't stop singing and dancing about, you know, being in a chair and being proud of that and, you know, being lucky to be alive. I celebrate that, you know, the chair is what helps me get around. It's what helps me live, you know, a really fulfilled and happy life. So I'm always grateful for it now. But in those early days, that wasn't always the case. So, yeah, being introduced to sport in that way definitely helped me accept who I was and embrace it.
And do you think sport and the Paralympics in general then is really crucial for helping people get, you know, people understand what disabled athletes go through, and also, you know, someone who might be in a similar situation who starts off as an able-bodied, for want of a better phrase, then has a life-changing accident, to have greater awareness and greater exposure of the Paralympics and all the different sports that are going on outside of the Paralympics day to day as well? Do you think, how crucial do you think that is?
Just unbelievably important, because you know what, a spinal cord injury can happen to anyone at any time, in any place, anywhere. You know, it's something that can literally happen in a split second of a moment, and your life can be completely turned upside down. And if you've been, you know, not against, but not exposing yourself to difference in the world, whether that's to do with race, gender, disability, you know, whatever it is, if you're so narrow-minded in your own way of living, you know, these things and these changes will happen around you, and you won't be as prepared as you would be had you not exposed yourself to what is so amazing in the whole diversity of this world that we live in. You know, so I just think that's something really important to me, that people do educate themselves. You know, it's people's ignorance more than anything, that they don't you know, have the understanding around different disabilities, because it doesn't affect them. You know, but that's not to say that, you know, I think there's 25 million disabled people in the UK of a population of what, something like 67 million. So a third, you know, and we're not represented a third of the time. So, you know, I think a lot more people can be doing a lot more to be, proactively watching and employing and encouraging and supporting disabled people in general, and obviously for me, disabled female athletes. So yeah, it's crucial, you know, and the Paralympics being out there is good, but it's not good enough. You know, it's one time every 4 years that we're seen, and a lot more visual than for my sport anyway. I know athletics gets a lot more coverage, and some other sports do at different times in that 4 year cycle, but for me, it needs to be seen more. You know, women's sport in general is getting a lot more coverage now. You know, the focus has been on that for a long time. And that's not to say that needs to stop, but we need to go to the next level and we need to represent everybody now. And on a parity as well. Not like sometimes I get frustrated that the Paralympics sort of comes as secondary to the Olympics, because it's, I don't know, in some people's opinions, it's lesser than, which is not the case, you know, and I think we're often, as disabled athletes, portrayed as, you know, the superhuman campaign was out there, and, you know, everyone bought into that at the time, and it was great, but, you know, looking back on it, it's not anything superhuman. We're just athletes. You know, yes, we've overcome barriers, but tell me an able-bodied athlete that hasn't overcome a barrier in their sporting career to get to where they are now. We're all superhuman. You know, our disabilities are obviously just a lot more visual. That's not to say that we are more super just because we're getting out of bed in the morning and getting on with our life, you know. So I would love to challenge that a bit more and challenge people's perceptions around, you know, what they think disabled athletes are capable of, because it is on par with what Olympians are doing, you know, and I think it should be seen in the same light.
Very interesting point you make there. And something I've noticed quite a few athletes come out and say now is that, you know, that I think the superhuman tag was meant well. But it is now you look back at it, it is sort of still highlighting the differences when actually what exactly what you guys are doing is the same as an able-bodied athlete in terms of overcoming barriers. It's just different. And does it frustrate you then, though, the way everyone's talking about at the moment? It's always the Tokyo Olympics, it's never the Paralympics, or if it is, it's like an afterthought almost.
Yeah, it is frustrating. And I almost find myself, when people do say the Olympics and the Paralympics, I'm almost like, oh, wow, thank you for including us, you know, which I should never be. You know, that should be the standard. And it should be, if you don't include us, I should be annoyed. You know, the Olympics and the Paralympics are the two, well, apart from the World Cup in football, the next biggest sporting event in the whole entire world. Like, and we're not mentioning one of them, like when they're, you know, the same event, but for different groups of people. And often the newspapers, media are just disregarding that the Paralympics even exist. And I don't know if it's because they think saying the Olympics, it means it includes both, but it doesn't. You know, they're two completely different events. You wouldn't say, Wimbledon, and expect people to think you meant Wimbledon and Queens. Like, you know, they're two different events. You talk about them in their own right. Sometimes, you know, it's tough because, you know, you want people to change, but I also understand, you know, being an able-bodied human at one point in my life, that if you're not necessarily exposed all the time, it's not in your path, you know. So and I think with the Olympics coming up first and all the talk around COVID and if it's even going to go ahead, I think, you know, there's a lot of conversation around that. I would love to see it being on par with, you know, the adverts that are coming out now are all about the Olympics. I would love to see that backed up with and the Paralympics, you know, and it come, you know, the same adverts coming out for both. But they're two different companies and they're ran in two different ways. So, you know, you'll never get that equality, I don't think, necessarily, when one is just 2 weeks before the other. I don't know, it's, if you span it the other way, if the Paralympics were first and then the Olympics, I don't know how that would look, or how that would feel, you know, with the hype leading up to it. Maybe that would help in a sense, I don't know. I'm just rambling again. But yeah, it's really interesting conversation anyway around all of that.
It's interesting that the Commonwealth Games, they've started to bring in some para sports, one of another best phrase, you know, they're running concurrently. So it'd be interesting, you know, what that's like going forwards. But
that runs well, but it's obviously not as big an event. Whereas, you know, the Olympics in itself and the Paralympics in itself are massive events. To try and combine the two would probably be a mammoth task. And I think having them in their own as their own thing, you know, I would prefer that, I think, because then the focus is just on us for those 2 weeks. I think maybe when you combine the two, the disability sport side of it can maybe get lost sometimes. It's like when you're watching the London Marathon, you watch the wheelchair racers for about 5 minutes of their marathon, and then you're watching runners who can't even run, you know, for the whole 5, 10 to 10 hours of them running, you know, whereas there's an elite performers going on at the moment and the coverage is just not the same. So, you know, it's a much deeper and wider debate, I think, that is probably ongoing above our heads, but maybe one day I'll be in that position to have those conversations.
Definitely. Another thing as well is that the Olympics and the Paralympics are also shown on different channels now. I think at Rio, and I mean, I can't fault the job Channel 4 do with the budget and sort of the lack of resources compared to the BBC. I think they did an amazing job, and, you know, with the last leg and everything as well, creating a lot of debate and promoting it really well. But is that, as an athlete, you know, yes, it's on free-to-air TV, but I mean, at Rio and London, for example, the BBC had 24/7 coverage on two channels all day, and then BBC4, and then all the streams of the, I don't know if they've announced it yet, but I'm going to say it anyway, they have got a much limited coverage on BBC this time, and Eurosport have got a lot more. But does that frustrate you that, you know, the BBC have lost or not chosen to take on the Paralympics, when, you know, this is a chance for you guys to really, as you say, talk about promoting what disabled people can do, and just amazing sports on offer, because they're so good to watch.
Yeah, it's disappointing, I think, because it's that whole thing of it being lesser than. So they obviously thought, I mean, I can't speak for anybody at the BBC, but, you know, they obviously thought, well, we'll have the Olympics and we're not really bothered about the Paralympics, which is disappointing. But, you know, someone would probably at the top say it was to do with budget or something, or they wanted to give someone else a try. You know, can't fault the Channel 4 at all as well. You know, they do a great job of covering it. But yeah, that, I think it's just that lack of respect probably of where we want to be. And, you know, it's, I don't think it's through anyone's fault of not trying to be there and be put on, you know, what is the number one channel in the UK. We would want to be seen on there, and, you know, hopefully they will show highlights or they will show something on the news. That, you know, that would be nice, but I just hope it's not a token gesture, and hopefully in some time, you know, in the future, whether it's Channel 4 or it's whoever, you know, that there's enough like viewing around it, and there's enough fans. That's what's more important to me, is who listens to it, who's watching it, you know, not what channel it's on, I suppose. It's if we can get people watching and we can get more fans, that creates, you know, a better sporting environment. So ultimately that's the that's the goal.
And on a really positive note, British Wheelchair Basketball have taken the ball by the horns, and they've launched the Women's Premier League, which is the first para sport league in the UK and the first of its kind for women's wheelchair basketball across the world. Yeah. At a time where a lot of sports are having to, you know, count the pennies because of what's happened with COVID, this is a really bold move, but it's a brilliant move. And when you first heard about it, how excited were you?
Yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, to bring the women's sport to the forefront of, you know, the sport as a whole, to invest that much in women's sport specifically. You know, there was a time when I first joined the programme that we were sort of secondary to the men. That's changed a lot, like, don't get me wrong. And now it's, you know, we are being invested in heavily, and that's, it's amazing. And I just hope it takes off, you know, for the younger generation to come through and to compete and to play at that high level, to play with and against elite athletes who have trained day in, day out. I think it's amazing to see the sport, like, you know, ramping it up a notch. And yeah, I just, you know, I'm hoping that it creates a lot more buzz around the sport, a bigger fan base, that ultimately will help with more sponsorship, you know, more support for us as GB athletes as well as the clubs, and just giving the recognition that we deserve, you know, that promotion side of it, that giving more athletes a stage and a voice, to be able to, you know, share what they're doing and share their passions and their interests. So it's what, you know, any athlete deserves, I think, to be recognised for their success. So, yeah, I mean, great job by them. They've also been doing an Inspire a Generation programme, which runs alongside really nicely, which is all about, you know, just getting more people involved in the sport as well. So at a grassroots level, getting more coaches, more volunteers, more referees, anything, you know, and obviously players as well. But understanding that anybody can play the sport, you know, whether you've got a disability or not, actually, it's one of the most inclusive sports that there is out there, because able-bodied people can play as well. And you play on a pretty much level playing field because you're all sat in chairs. So it's great for those people who want to be able to play a sport with their friends, and they may have a disability and their friends don't. So yeah, they've been making waves at the moment, and it's a great time to be part of our programme in British Wheelchair Basketball.
And especially so given, you know, fingers crossed it all happens, what's coming up in the next few months. A very exciting time, I guess. What are you most excited about, and what are you sort of hoping, what are you hoping happens in terms of both sort of how the team do and also just how the sport, women's sport and disability sport, you know, grow and progress over the next few months and the next few years as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just excited to be there, honestly. I think it'll be a real relief actually getting there safely, having got through all this, what has been a bit of a mess, you know, in the world at the moment, and got through that in one piece and be playing our first game. That'll be, you know, that's what I'm most excited about. Obviously there is, you know, goals to be achieved and medals to be won. And I have my fingers tightly crossed that we have put ourselves in a good enough position through the training we've been doing that we give ourselves a really good chance of succeeding and bringing home a medal. I think if you'd have asked me before COVID, I was very much like, that's what we need, and that's what success looks like, is a gold medal around our necks, when actually success is getting there and performing and doing our best and showing up, you know, despite the barriers and everything that we've faced along the way, as, you know, most sports have, apart from mental ball. I am joking. Everyone, you know, has gone through some change and some difficulty. But yeah, despite all that, I think success for us would be there and be competing and focus on us. So that's what I'm most looking forward to, is just really focusing on ourselves and keeping our fingers tightly crossed that equals a success for us, which would, you know, hopefully be a Paralympic medal.
Well, I know, speaking for myself, I cannot wait to see yourself, Amy, and the team in action over the next few months, and I'm sure all our listeners will say the same. Thank you, Sophie, for joining us for a very wide-ranging but a generally fantastic interview, and yeah, we wish you all the very best.
Well, thank you so much. It's been really nice to chat.
A massive thank you once again to Sophie, and we cannot wait to see more of what she achieves on and off the court in the upcoming weeks, months and years. Sportspill will be back very soon, so make sure you've liked, rated and subscribed on all of your usual podcast providers, while also following @SportspillPod across social media.